Hello, I'm Father Ray Petrucci. Welcome to Thoughts for the Week. We are going to have an interesting program today with an interesting guest. But before we get into all of that, it is my mission to turn to you, our listeners, and ask for your input, to share your ideas, your thoughts. Maybe there's a topic or two that you would like us to investigate, maybe bring in some experts, talk about. We'd love to hear from you, in other words. What I'd like you to do is consider one of two ways, either to put a stamp on an envelope and address it to Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466. That's Thoughts for the Week, Post Office Box 7466, Greenwich, Connecticut. Now, the zip code in Greenwich is 06836. That's 06836. If you would rather email us, do so at clemens10@aol.com. Let me spell Clemens for you, C-L-E-M-O-N-S, then the number 10, at aol.com. I encourage you, while you're on the computer, to please consider going to our internet magazine, Spirituality for Today. And you could find that at spirituality.org. spirituality.org. And you'll find some articles and other features, and especially you'll find our radio program, Thoughts for the Week. Not only one a particular program, but archived. So you might look at a few different topics and decide to listen at your leisure, your convenience. Now, my next task is first to let you know my co-host, Mrs. Dorothy Riera, could not be with us today. Fortunately, my guest could be with us, and we're delighted to welcome a man who is involved with the diocese in a way that perhaps we as those who've listened to this program may not have heard from before. And we talked to an awful lot of professors and awful lot of theologians or people dealing with things with the diocese. But in welcoming today Deacon Patrick Toole, we're finding a deacon whose background is functioning now in the diocese in a very special way. First, let me welcome Deacon Patrick Toole. Welcome.
Thank you, Father Ray.
Delighted.
Great to be with
you.
Thank you.
Now, you are the Episcopal Delegate for Administration of the Diocese of Bridgeport. Now, this Episcopal Delegate, does that say something about who you're answerable to directly, or...
Answerable to the bishop, right.
So there's no middleman for you. You're directly to him.
I guess not.
Okay. Now, before we get into so many of the things you're involved in, first off, just in general, what does the is your function within the diocese itself?
Yeah, I think in the secular world, people may think of it as a chief operating officer role, where I really help coordinate the major offices of the Catholic Center. And that includes things as diverse as communications to human resources, information technology, and cemeteries, et cetera.
Now, does this mean that you're kind of overseeing what they're doing and how they're doing it, and is it functioning within the desire of what the bishop as their mission, all that?
Exactly. I mean, all of us are there really for the single person purpose of helping people meet Christ one person at a time, and we do that through the threefold duties of the bishop, which are to sanctify, educate, and govern. Mm-hmm. So all of us are really in support of his role as bishop of our diocese and his mission in the church.
Hmm. Now, you've been a deacon 7 years, I believe?
7 years in June.
Okay.
Yeah, coming up on my anniversary.
Now, you were involved in an awful lot of things besides just your diocesan work and parish work as a deacon. Could you tell us a little bit about, and I know I'm going to mispronounce it again, Hoving?
Walter Hovingham, yes, in Garrison, New York, yeah. It's a center that helps women with addiction rehabilitate. It's a residence program. Mm-hmm. It's about 11 or 12 months. They can house about 100 women on their campus, and our role there is one of a woman I worked with at IBM heard the story of a woman who was addicted to heroin, and how when she found Christ in her life and went through the Hoving program, mm-hmm. How her whole life turned around. And as she sat there and listened to this woman's story, she said that she had always thought that people with addictions was their fault. But when mm-hmm. she heard this woman's story, how she was introduced to drugs at age 8 by her brother's best friend, how she had to take care of her whole family because her mother was a drug addict. And she started thinking, this could have been me. In that environment, this could have been me. And so in any event, she quit IBM, and she started a nonprofit called Unshattered, and she asked me to join her in this endeavor on the board. So I serve as vice chairman. And our job is to walk with these women as part of the Hobeam program. We're part of their work study component, meaning they come to us in the afternoon, and we teach them how to design and make handbags and purses. And we sell those on the Internet to help them pay for their fees at the Hobeam home.
Now, this is certainly a very, very contemporary topic.
It is.
The idea with addiction.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. So a person approaches and enters into a residence.
They do, or sometimes they're court ordered. We do deal with some, as an example, Paterson, New Jersey sends us a number of women who they feel would benefit from the program because they have a 90%+ success factor at Hobeam Home.
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite remarkable. And it was started by a man, Walter Hobeam, I believe, was, I might get this wrong, but I think he was chairman of Tiffany and donated the mansion that the women live in. In any event, there was a man who started evangelizing in New York City to women who were drug addicts and prostitutes, and then founded this Hobeam home with the support of this gentleman to really create a program that was Christ-centered that would help them get back on the path of life again.
The faith-based program like that, mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how what the feeling are or what motivates the addicted person to be open to that. Because I can imagine, I mean, their life may be drugs,
mm-hmm.
and you know, in a sense, their God is a drug, or they may be people who simply became addicted. Is this possible? I mean, I'm just speaking through illness or something. All of a sudden, they become addicted to painkillers. Or
each woman has their own story. Mm-hmm. Each is heartbreaking, and I would say, in general, they or someone who loves them reaches the conclusion that they need help, and they have nowhere else to turn. They've heard about the program, and they enter it, and it's really hard. Those first couple months, they don't want to be there in many cases, but they fight it. They fight it out, and it's a process. I can't even describe, you know, the suffering that these women have gone through, and yet, at some point, they discover the fact that they are loved. And this changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
They are beautiful. They have value. They have worth. And then life changes for them dramatically. And why? Because they've met the person of Jesus Christ.
I was about to say, there's where this comes in. And that, if I'm like from John's gospel, God so loved the world. And that love for the world is that which becomes the reason for redemption of all of us. And again, yeah, when we recognize that we're loved and cared for, that's what changes things for them.
Exactly. And then what we do is we collect discarded materials or used materials for these purses and handbags, and then they make something beautiful out of it. And one thing I find so touching is that when the women are doing the final seam inside the lining, they will write a Bible verse specifically for the person who is to receive it, who they don't know.
Oh, wow.
And they sew it, and that's hidden. So it's kind of their gift to that person.
A little signature.
A little signature. Yeah, it's really quite beautiful.
I was about to ask. I mean, certainly it's a fundraising effort, but I said there's got to be a lot more to working on that than just making handbags.
Oh,
and,
sure.
And it's yours. Yeah, it carries with it something very special there. Wow. And so that's a very successful program. Do people who are involved in the program come back to work in the program or become?
They do. What we did is we found that what's hard for these women, if they go back to their old neighborhoods, they can easily fall back into the same traps because
the same world,
it triggers, right? So we found a space that's about 5,000 square feet up in Hopewell Junction, New York, and we built a studio there for women when they exit the program so they can get another year or two. We pay them, and they're hired as part of Unshattered, the mm-hmm. nonprofit that we set up, and we help them continue to build their skill, their design skills, their craftsmanship of making these handbags, and then we find people in the community where they can live with, or eventually they have their own apartment. And it's amazing to see these women. We have a young woman now who's in her early 20s. Mm-hmm. She just got accepted at community college.
Oh,
and so
wow.
For the first time in her life, she's mm-hmm. taken a major step forward. We have another woman who's now become our supervisor, who recently got married, and she's expecting her first child soon. So for the first time, she bought a car. I mean, you know, you see this life transformational things happening that they had no opportunity before to attain. Yeah,
it's nice that that Hovi tends to work, and Unshattered tends to really work with that process of not just trying to help them break the addiction, but also to enter into life. In a way that will help them make truly a better life for themselves and avoid slipping back.
Exactly, and only through God's grace.
Yeah, well,
thanks
that
be to God.
Is phenomenal. You know, I wonder if you could, because it's so fascinating. I wonder if you could talk to us a little bit, because I'm sure that those listening, if they don't have been involved with that, perhaps themselves or family members, probably not all that far from some story of addiction. The stages of recovery, could you elaborate a little bit more about what you've seen or what are the stages of recovery?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not an expert on that, but I would just say observationally that I do think that I wish I could remember the author, Father Ray, but there was this beautiful book called Addiction and Grace, mm-hmm. Written by a doctor who, after years, he came to the conclusion, I can only do minimal. Only by God's grace can these people really be healed. And I think the recovery for us is getting the women comfortable enough so they're open to that final, that ultimate step of really allowing God to work on them and mm-hmm. to shape and mold them. Prior to that, my observation is it's a struggle. It's a struggle to get the women mm-hmm. to really face what is the root cause of their addictions, to really feel that they do have value and worth. And so it's, as I said, it's about an 11-month process to get them to the point where they can start to rejoin society.
Is there a lot of professional counseling going on?
There is.
That period of
yes,
time?
There is. The women start every day in prayer, and then they move into this counseling, and then the afternoons they go into different work groups, and Unshattered is one of those work groups.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's interesting when I preach on addiction or stories like these women, it's amazing how many people come up to me and say it's in my family.
Yeah.
You know, where can we get help? And this is an area where I really think the services of Catholic Charities and other Christian-based services out there are so needed and beneficial to the people in our diocese. It's sadly, it's a problem that's getting worse.
When you look at this program, and it seems like there's a lot of financial support for it, is any government help there, or is it through people of means who are simply devoting themselves to the program?
Yeah, I'm not sure about Walter Hovind Home, but not for Unshattered. It's all donations from
it's all donations.
Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah,
it's wonderful.
Yeah, and of course the money we raise through our sales.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh. That's really good. You know, it's nice to hear these types of stories, because I wasn't familiar with this in the past, and but it's great to hear not only a successful story, but one in which you simply find, if you're looking for God active in the world and active in people's lives, you know, you certainly see it in that. I hate to look back to the diocese again, but
love to, actually.
When you think about the idea of planning, all these businesses, they always come up with either a business plan, strategic planning. What does that mean as far as the function of a diocese or what you do?
Sure. We started a couple years ago, actually at the parish level, working with the 82 parishes on a pastoral plan over the next 3 years for each parish. And they've identified needs, whether it be in faith formation or in liturgical needs, in infrastructure, evangelization, whatever it happens to be. And so now we're working with them to make sure that we can help them with concrete plans to help support them both at the parish level, and then look at what should we be doing at a diocesan level.
Mm.
So it's been a major undertaking, and we're really starting to see the fruits of it starting to take root.
A lot of this is still coming into being.
It is. Yeah. We went through about a year plus of just planning, and now we're just moving into the implementation phase.
Wow. What areas does the diocese prioritize in regard to its overall functioning and everything I'm talking about? I know you mentioned the bishop's role.
Mm-hmm.
And does that really set the mission of a diocese? Or
I think it does. If you think about, you know, the summit of the Christian life is the Eucharist, the Holy Eucharist. And so we think about our sacramental life and all we need to do to support that in our parishes.
Mm-hmm.
But then, of course, helping people find truth, education is critical. Catholic education mm-hmm. is a major priority for the diocese. We're doing so many innovative things with blended learning and creating new structures of how Catholic education is delivered, really with a deep Catholic identity centric purpose, and bringing the latest techniques and knowledge with high quality to our students. So Catholic education is a major priority, and of course charity, bringing the love of God to the people and fulfilling the needs that we have as a society. So I would say those three priorities of, you can almost say, I like St. Thomas Aquinas, helping people find truth, goodness, and beauty in life.
Mm-hmm.
And it really, it fits well with our, formation and education and charity.
We've had Dr. Cheeseman as a guest.
Oh,
in
yes.
The past,
yeah,
and,
our superintendent.
And I was reading a little bit about some of these new educational models.
Mm-hmm.
What do they, again, I'm not sure how deeply you get involved with this, but what are they trying to achieve? Or what is the model actually doing that's somewhat different than the past?
I think it's really unleashing the ability to allow students to learn at their own pace and to be able to broaden the techniques that we allow kids to get educated in, whether it be some sort of online learning or these new robotics laboratories, STEM courses that we're bringing into schools, as well as with the traditional in-classroom teaching. It's taking all these new ways that we now know how children learn and helping adapt the program for each individual so that they can learn at the best pace for them and get the most out of their education. It's really, really exciting, I think. And, of course, all centered in our Catholic identity.
This is fascinating because you're almost picking up dramatic changes. When you think of the types of changes that occurred from the 19th to the 20th century, all that had happened, and that from the Wright brothers to Henry Ford to all the rest of them, and now you're seeing, I think, very dramatic changes from the 20th into the 21st. Do you, of course, your background is heavily involved in that. What do you, or how do you picture things emerging, and how do you think the church needs to get involved?
Well, I would say that we're finding that, maybe unfair to say, but perhaps the old model was we would leave the church doors open and whoever comes in is welcome. But now I think because of technology and our ability to reach so many more people on a mass scale, we're now bringing the good news and being much more active evangelizing through digital media and other ways to meet people where they are and to help them encounter Christ where they may not have had that opportunity. So I feel that it's like everything. Technology can really hurt and get in the way because it could distract people and it become an attachment. On the other hand, it's a tremendous vehicle for us to help spread the gospel message.
Now, the diocese has an area that deals with all of this?
We do. In our communication team, we have a dedicated staff managing our social media, and we're really, really excited and proud of what they've achieved. I think in Facebook rankings, we're somewhere in the United States. Our diocese is, in terms of followers, is somewhere in the top 10. I think we're fifth or sixth.
Really?
So for a little diocese like us, the team has done really a tremendous job.
Wow. And you bring your past into that, I presume? Or
I do my best to, but we have an incredibly talented team. We're very blessed at the diocesan level. We are.
Do you find that things are hitting a point where certain structures or models are pretty solid, or does technology still, by the time you buy it, it's going to be obsolete in 6 months? Is it still something like that?
It happens. It does. It does. The acceleration of technology outstrips our ability to consume it. Yeah, no question. But on the other hand, we really have no alternative but to try to keep up.
Because when I thought, as a young person growing up, you had the diocese and newspaper.
Right.
That was it.
Right. And what's interesting is the paper is still probably the most used source of information.
Is it really?
It is. I mean, it reaches over 100,000 people. I forget the exact circulation, but we direct mail those to people's homes, and it's where people still, in a sense, prefer and enjoy getting it every month and reading about what's happening and finding news. It's interesting. As much as people talk about the press going away, we haven't actually seen that with at least in our little world.
Yeah, and also when you talk about leisure time again, that probably is the printed word allows you to sit back and not only read, but also go back and reread and think about it and ponder it, rather than anything moving along, just bam, bam, bam.
It does, you know? It does, yeah. And it's complementary. You know, I don't think it's either or. We need to be excellent at both print and digital.
I can see you have to be involved in every other area. And, you know, I say that, you know, thinking about, the paper, yeah, that's what I used to do. And then, yet here we are at the radio. I think that was part of the dramatic radio and television efforts in the past. Now the social media is one of the primary ways, I think, especially reaching out to the younger half of our population today, I would think.
And even radio. I mean, you think about the great service that you and your program provide to the people of this diocese and beyond. And in St. Rose of Lima, because technology is available and you can do this, they actually have their own radio station now.
Do they?
They do. And they're broadcasting masses, and they're broadcasting Vatican programs, and I'll tell them they should broadcast your program as well if that's allowed.
Of course, that parish is big enough to have its own radio.
But as you said, there's so many ways to reach people, and it's now affordable, and we should be using all of these vehicles to reach as many as we can.
You know, I want to go back a little bit because we talked a little bit about this with the diaconate and the importance of your discernment and the spirituality part of this. What finally, or what is it that let's say pushed you or finally ignited the fact that you're going to do this and you're going to explore this? How many years were you at IBM?
33 years.
33 years, and you were chief operating?
Information officer.
Information officer.
Yeah.
For the global thing. I guess I'm saying, what happened? What generated this? Because it's a big step to look at the diac.
Yeah, it was, and I guess, you know, as I reflect on it, it was a little bit of a slow burn in that I have five children, and so that kept me, still keeps me busy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But around 1999, 2000, I started thinking about, the children were still young, and then in 2005, I came down with pneumonia, and I was sitting in bed, and it just so happened it was the 2 weeks where Pope John Paul II was dying, and watching his life in review, things that were said about him, his great witness to the faith, I just kept thinking, well, if I get out of this bed, now's the time. You know, it's been in the back of my mind, but I really need to do something. I need to devote my life to our Lord in the best way that I feel I'm being called to do. And then literally after I got out of that bed, a few days later, as I was getting ready for work, my wife walks in with a brochure for the diaconate and says, you know, I really think you should look into this. And so for me, that was the affirmation that now's the time.
So interestingly enough, the illness put you in a different daily experience.
It did.
Which allowed you to sit back and think a lot more.
Which happens a lot when we go through suffering, right?
Yeah,
We think and reevaluate, and we have that silent time because it's not much else to do when you're sick.
That's right. And how does the diaconate program work in the diocese? What did you have to do?
It's changed since when I was in the program. It was 4.5 years, and we went 1 weekend a month. There's a small building in Bridgeport next to the Catholic Center that used to be, I believe, a convent. Mm. And they have about 24 bedrooms. But anyways, we would go in Friday night. We would come out Sunday night. we would take classes for those 4.5 years. And that was essentially the program. But now classes are taught a little bit up here and a little bit at St. Joseph Seminary in Dunwoody. Mm. So the men, when they graduate, they actually, if successful, they receive a master's in theology from St. Joseph's.
I was just about to bring that up. Now you have the seminary.
We have that component now, which the men seem to really enjoy and love.
Very good. Now, you're retired. Do you find most deacons are retired?
Well, I would say maybe a third. From their former working world.
But
many, you know, when I was ordained, I was, I believe, around 49 years old.
Oh, so you're right.
And the youngest I can recall is probably 38, 40. But I would say the average age is probably early to mid-50s, something like that, at ordination. But we need all men and younger men. So I hope there's men out there discerning. And if so, we would love to talk to you. Mm.
And so it's right now basically a 5-year program. And,
yes.
They would go through a process of discernment.
Yep, that's
learn
right.
About what the life is and sort of go from there. What have you found as far as how does the family respond to this new, I hate to say lifestyle, new vocation that you're involved in?
Yeah, my family's been incredibly supportive, even to this day where the children are grown. The ones in the area still come back to hear me preach, which I'm grateful for, because there's always, I can count on at least somebody liking it or giving me that affirmation. But without that support, I could not have done it. I definitely could not have done it.
Now, does the diocese reach out to wives and family too? Do they have programs or anything to involve them?
We do, and even Widows of Deacons. We still encourage and invite them to join us when we get together. Uh-huh. And we have convocations and so forth. So they're all part of the community. Mm-hmm. But my first vocation is to my marriage, and so mm-hmm. I have to continue to remind myself mm-hmm. that's first. But it's just been such a grace-filled experience to be a deacon. I couldn't be more grateful that I've been given that opportunity.
Well, I'm delighted that you're involved. This is a great time having spent this time with you. To our listeners, we've been speaking to Deacon Patrick Toole. And Deacon Patrick is the Episcopal Delegate for Administration of the Diocese of Bridgeport. And a tremendously important function, because no matter how spiritual things become, and we want the spiritual element there, you still have to make the lights go on. Well, we thank you so much, Deacon Patrick, for being with us.
Thank you, Father Ray. It's been a great pleasure.
Had a great time with you. Take good care, and to our listeners, please join us again next time.